Religion on the Line. 2 hours of exploration into the world of spirituality, faith, hope, love, or the hot buttons of today. Talk about it now. 576-7710. And now, Religion on the Line.
Good morning. You've got Religion on the Line, the show where we come together and discuss issues of faith, spirituality, current issues of the day in light of a theological perspective, and just comfort each other as we're going together on this journey of faith. I'm Bill Scholl with the Social Justice Consultant for the Archdiocese of Kansas City, Kansas. I'm joined in studio with
Pastor Barry Freese, retired United Methodist pastor, along with...
Hello, Rabbi, are you there?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You're along with...
Oh! Forgive me, guys. Rabbi Michael Zedek, Rabbi Emeritus, Temple B'nai Yehuda.
Yeah, I'm sitting in at the helm, handling calls for the Reverend Bob Hill. He will be joining us shortly remotely, but I think Michael's used to the intro guy.
No,
waxing,
I hate to say
waxing
it,
a little more poetic.
I was off the phone for a second, attending to something. I thought I had my computer says it's 6:05, and obviously it's wrong.
Well, usually Bob gives you a lot more time because he's a lot more eloquent.
Bob.
Yes.
Well, he does.
Anyway, well, Bill, welcome back. And Barry, it's good to have you there.
Always a pleasure, Michael. Always a pleasure. I never leave without learning something.
All right. Now let's see if we can go to... I'm handling the phones today, so let's see how that goes. Let's see.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. This is Bob Hill, and coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, where the General Assembly of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ in the U.S. and Canada is meeting in together this weekend, and also up till Wednesday. So I'm here with some 3,500 other close friends, and
well, do give them our best regards.
I will indeed. You know, some people were asking me if I was going to do the show, and I said, well, barely. I'm just going to do, I've got a great friend, Barry Freese, subbing for me, but they were aware of the show and in almost disbelief, understanding how long it had been going on. So...
Yeah, with 25 years.
Yeah, we're in our 25th year.
No, it's not as long as these conferences have been going on.
Well, you
what,
know,
what, are any, what if any
18,
issues
you know,
that are
50, 18,
going to be
60, something
some
like that.
Debate and discussion?
Yeah, you know, we don't even have, we don't call it debate anymore. Oh. That's too bad for me. I think that it should be called debate, but it's not. But there are issues that come up. As Michael, you're suggesting, it sounds like you've been to a convention or two before.
That's true. And,
so, Barry, these are not as publicly momentous as maybe the Methodist ones have been of late. We don't have too many controversial issues. The biggest thing that we're doing is we're electing a new general minister and president, Terry Owen, who will be elected tonight. And there's even a offering of the ballots as a liturgical moment, if you can believe
interesting
that.
Interesting how you can work that offering word in there.
Yeah, yeah, into the very event itself. Mm. So,
are there any hot buttons of the day at these for your 3,500 close friends?
Yeah, not to my way of thinking, there isn't. Not this year. There have been. A year or two before, from Orlando to Columbus to this year, we've had Orlando to maybe Nashville. They run together after a while, you know. It was, what does all mean? If all are welcome at our table, what does that mean? And we have communion. As many people may know, we're a denomination that celebrates communion every Sunday and or every time we gather. and who's welcome at the communion table, who's welcome to participate in communion. That's been a big question for some, not for many, but for some. And so we've had some debates over that, but nothing like that this year.
Well, good. We're the Methodists, of course, just meet every 4 years. There is, though, in a couple years, a special session that's been called to meet here in Missouri, actually, in St. Louis. And, of course, the topic that's driving much of it is who thinks they're correct about how a group of Christians treats LGBT folks, Q folks. Will they be ordained? Will they be allowed to be married in our churches by our folk, by our pastors? And the current thinking, and very generally, is that there's thoughts that the probability of a theological solution, in other words, one side yielding it or the groups meeting in the middle, is pretty slim. Everybody's pretty well entrenched. Of course, history will tell you that progress will happen, and of course, it's happened in marriage terms in the Supreme Court, and that's pretty much the law of the land now. But we've got these pockets of places where that's not allowed in the churches. And so the thinking is that a structural solution, some kind of way for groups that believe one way or the other to be still in connection with the Wesleyan movement, and have that not be determined solely on one or two issues. You know, my thinking back to your phrase, what is all, the catchphrase, all means all, seems to be... It seems to be where I land, from the Psalms, where it says, all who call on the name of the Lord will be saved. On to examples like Galatians, where the author there wrote, there's no longer Greek nor Jew, male nor free, or male nor female, slave or free. So that's where I land, but it's a big topic for us, and it's going to go on for years, probably.
And Bob, has your denomination had similar discussions?
Yes, very similar. And there's no imposition of a rule upon a local congregation. The question would be, does the national church ever condemn any local church that does do that, that does not draw the line, that does welcome all, and or how many of our churches do? Or how much support is there for a local church that does exclude on the basis of gender or on the basis of race or on the basis of sexual orientation? And while we would be understood to be a pretty progressive denomination, but there is not a condemnation of anybody for any reason from the national level on. And that would cause some local congregations very great consternation, and they would, but very few. There are not a lot of congregations that would. What they would do is they wouldn't have consternation. They'd just leave the denomination, and they've done that. And that's what's facing the Methodist expression is come over the Presbyterians as well, which is enough of those churches or individual congregations don't agree with an inclusive perspective, and they leave, and they form either a new denomination, or they just become independent, or things like that. So
yeah, the current status is that the United Methodist Church officially is not inclusive. We've got language that prohibits us, in theory at least, from ordaining. The fancy phrase is self-avowed practicing homosexuals and doing marriages. The reality is that there are people that have been ordained for decades that are LGBTQ folks, and there's weddings that go on as well. So much of the, a certain slice, let's say, is finger-pointing where, you know, you're not supposed to do this, or an otherwise compassionate administrator, a bishop, for example, would be required by our particular set of rules to take action when someone comes out officially. So that's a part of the challenge.
Reverend Hill, can you stay with us over the break? We're up against
I can stay. You bet. Yeah, okay. I can stay for one more segment.
All right.
Love
if, you, if you'd like to join this discussion, you can call us at 816-576-7710. We'll be right back. You've got Religion on the Line. We are joined in studio with Pastor Barry Freese.
Hello, good morning.
I'm Bill Scholl, the social justice consultant for the Archdiocese of Kansas City, Kansas. And we also have on the line
Rabbi Robert Lee Gill, Minister Emeritus of Community Christian Church.
You can tell it's a rookie hour here. If you'd like to join the discussion here on Religion Live.
Nobody can join while Bob is on.
Oh, that's right. All right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. So anyway, write down this number, 816-576-7710.
If commit you wanna, it to memory, then eat it.
If you want to call and comment on any of the things we've been talking about. Thank you, Rabbi, for reminding me of that. So we were talking about the issue of inclusion, particularly how do our congregations handle situations in which people who are as Barry said, self-avowed practicing homosexuals do or
that's the official United Methodist
their official phrase. What is your congregation's stance on that? Do we ordain them? Do we allow them to practice openly in our congregations? But Bob, that's not a question you're dealing with right now at your conference.
No, we've settled that question for ourselves in terms of a denominational staff, position, and it is all means all, and we welcome all, and there's no condemnation for anybody regarding any perspective of who they are. There's some common sense stuff. We don't equate the status of being homosexual with anything that's immoral. We don't say that it's anything other than human, and human beings are human beings. We're all sinful and fall short of the glory of God, but there's no one act or one status or one way of being in the world that excludes anybody from the communion table, from the possibility of ordination or anything else. That's on the national level, yes, or general level, or in what we call the general manifestation of the church.
Now,
sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
Well, I'm with the Catholic Church, and of course, we take a different stance. Where the church would never ordain a man to the priesthood who was openly self-avowed, self-identified as gay.
And you wouldn't do a woman regardless of any kind of... See, we've been ordaining women since, I think, 1830-something, so...
But it seems like the...
We're going almost on to two centuries of ordaining women. Yeah. So that's another piece of it as well.
But it would seem to me that really what the crux of the argument would be is that the question of is having sex with someone of the same gender is that a sin? And what I'm hearing your congregation saying and Barry's position is no, it's not. It doesn't. I mean, it doesn't. Is that really kind of the crux of the argument?
I think the statement is it may not. It's not automatically a sin any more than it would be automatically a sin for a heterosexual couple to. But there may be sin involved in how we treat each other.
Yeah, in treating anybody as a thing is a sin, and that can happen in a marriage relationship as well as. Same-sex relationship. So that would be the you know, I said before, we frequently and not frequently, always, I suppose, and assume the sinfulness of all human beings. There's not, none are righteous, no, not one, is the phrase that Paul uses, and we would say that applies to everybody. But that doesn't exclude you from the gifts and graces that are offered to all people, nor from salvation.
But the question I would have is, are there any acts that are inherently sinful? Like, certainly, yes, any action, even a good action, can become sinful, but are there certain actions that are always wrong?
Yeah, I would say rape is always wrong.
We all agree that there are, but we would not agree as to what the typology of those actions automatically looks like.
Could you say more, Rabbi? What do you mean by typology?
Well, I don't automatically think, I don't agree with the church's teachings about the notion that ipso facto, there's just simply no way that a person who is homosexual could have a legitimately sacred relationship that would include physical expression. But I do think there are actions that when we exploit another, that is without question sinful, although it's also lots of other things. I do think there are actions that when we decide to impose on others our certainties, when there are other positions in a multivalent society, that's actually sinful. But that's just an abstraction, and I want to take advantage of it. I probably should be more quiet because Bob is only going to be able to be with us for a
while. No, I think you've expressed it beautifully and very articulately, and I think that if we get into a salacious description of physical activity and says to describe what is right and what is wrong, we're going to be on territory that is not very compelling, not very humane, and also just kind of icky, to use a technical term, I suppose. So,
now is that
could
icky
I
with a
quote
wire?
The President of the United States of America? Because one of the subtopics that we've been playing with for a number of weeks is our concern about civil conversation versus civil war, which many social critics have been suggesting it's the forces of light against the forces of evil, or darkness.
Yeah, that's not helpful.
So this is from an article by Peggy Noonan, who was speechwriter for Ronald Reagan and who writes a regular weekend opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal. It's quite remarkable. She begins a lovely passage. Now she's quoting. We write symphonies. This is the president at the G20. At Poland. We write symphonies. We pursue innovation. We celebrate our ancient heroes and always seek to explore and discover brand new frontiers. We reward brilliance. We strive for excellence. We treasure the rule of law and protect the right to free speech and free expression. We empower women as pillars of our society and our success. And we debate everything. We challenge everything. We seek to know everything so that we can better know ourselves. So this is her comment. If he talked like this at home, more of us would be happy to have him here. If he gives serious, thoughtful, prepared remarks only when traveling, he should travel more. And you're in Indianapolis, so keep being thoughtful, Bob. my only reason for citing it is that I think it's an outstanding description, whoever wrote the speech for the president, he gave it, of what is distinct in what we'll call Western civilization, because it was a speech about the nature of Western civilization, that we somehow are able to celebrate our diversity even if we can't harmonize our positions.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good way to put it. You know, what is happening on the presidential front is, I think, influenced by a guy named Steve Bannon and a bunch of people that would be associated with the alt-right that wants to take what is commonly called American exceptionalism to a new degree, and it's more like basically isolating America as and doing it in the service of the only thing that will be good and the way to be in the world. Anyway, so I'm glad to talk with you, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, looking forward to it.
Be safe.
got Religion on the Line, where we talk about matters of faith, belief, spirituality, morals, and everything in between. I'm Bill Scholl, the social justice consultant for the Archdiocese of Kansas City and Kansas, along with
Pastor Barry Freese, retired United Methodist pastor, along with
Rabbi Michael Zedek, Rabbi Emeritus, Temple B'nai Yehuda.
To join the conversation, give us a call, 816-576-7710. We want to hear from you. So Rabbi, what's
on my mind?
What's on your mind? Yeah.
Well, as it happens, I'd be very interested in commentaries on this one, because I'm not certain what the definitive is for sure. But and it was prompted in part by my visit to Kansas City this week. On July 4th was my brother-in-law and his wife, my sister-in-law's wedding anniversary, so we wanted to be there to celebrate with them. And the contretemps about renaming the J.C. Nichols Fountain because of some of Mr. Nichols' positions on matters of race paralleled with an article that appeared about the University of Mississippi is renaming one of its administration buildings when it was discovered publicly after an investigation that it's named after a man whose racist views, including the notion of lynching any and all African Americans in the state of Mississippi in order to maintain white supremacy, et cetera. But the question is there a, I don't know, a statute of limitations? Is there reason to remove Confederate monuments, et cetera? What's the moral position here? And is there one position that fits all? And I'd be very curious if people think the J.C. Nichols Fountain itself should be renamed. Have you guys been involved in this awareness at all?
No, this is breaking news for me. Nichols accused?
Well, far from expert on J.C. Nichols' biography, but you know, a man who clearly, in many ways, shaped the way the greater Kansas City area looks, both in terms of housing stock and in terms of racial divides and divisions, because clearly a proponent of and an implementer of what shorthand we'll call redlining.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That you're the wrong color to live here.
Or
and you're not going to be allowed to.
Some of those covenants.
And, Barry, I didn't hear you.
Perhaps also the wrong religion in some of those neighborhoods.
I don't doubt that was a probability, but I'm not sure.
Race was the bigger issue, but wasn't the only.
Yeah. But I'd be very, very interested in what people think about all of this. On the assumption that there's no definitive, of course, and in all cases, and went forever. I mean, you know, it reminds me ever so slightly of a certain kind of slippery slope, to wit, when one reads the writings of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he called the people of which he was most specifically a part Negroes, because that was the term of the time. And Abraham Joshua Heschel, his great rabbi colleague, always spoke about he and him, as opposed to they and them. You know, we now have a different kind of sensitivity that wasn't present, and we often have a different vocabulary. When does it stop? You know, so that's one issue. I'm also intrigued with. I've only recently gotten in at all information on this painful case of this 11-month-old born with what seems to be a terminal illness in Great Britain, Charlie Gard, and the fact that the hospital and the courts have determined to withdraw treatment, and now the involvement of others in trying to get him to get the child to the United States for an experimental treatment. Yet the European Court of Justice, is that what it's called, suggesting that the hospitals take precedence over the parents' desires, decisions on
wow.
this matter. And then my last one, I was listening to morning edition or whatever, weekend edition on National Public Radio yesterday as of getting ready for going to synagogue, and they were interviewing a Father James Martin, It was just recently built a book. My God, written a book called "Building a Bridge." There's how the mind can slip at this hour of the morning. The book is called "Building a Bridge," and the interview at least suggested that it was a concern about the fulsomeness of the response. He is a Catholic priest to the Pulse massacre, and what he believes the church needs to do in order to listen more fully to its community of gay people who are clearly in the church in whatever fashion they may or follow the teachings or the restrictions on them, etc. I don't know, Bill, if you'd heard of this guy or you may want to.
Father James Martin is fairly well known. I believe he's a Jesuit. I think he is with America Magazine, if not the editor, he'd be more on the left side of the spectrum of mm-hmm. the dialogue we have within the church. I'm not aware of this.
I think it's a new book.
Yes, I'll have to check that. I'll have to check that out.
Building a Bridge.
I'm personally involved in a ministry called Courage, the Courage Apostolate, and mm-hmm. that is a ministry it's a Catholic ministry, but you don't have to be Catholic to belong to it. It's a support group for Christians who experience same-sex attraction but don't want to act on those, mm-hmm. and it's a support group. We come together fairly regularly and sort of hold each other accountable. And I personally am not struggling with that issue. I have a lot of sin issues. I have a lot of attractions I wish I didn't have. But I help. It's one of the I help facilitate that group. And actually, it's uh-huh. been one of the most rewarding experiences I've had in ministry.
Tell us the name again.
It's called the Courage Apostolate.
Courage, okay.
And there are people. I prefer using the term same-sex attraction as opposed to gay or lesbian. Mm-hmm. I respect if people want to self-identify that, but there are individuals who through no choice of their own do experience a profound sexual attraction to the same gender, but don't want to act on it. I mean, I think that's mm-hmm. part of the human experience as well, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I have sexual attractions that I don't want to act on. I mean, that's part of
cultivating. If you're alive, that's not unusual.
Yeah. we have that ministry. And it looks like we have a call. We have Mike on line one. Mike, you're on Religion on the Line. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Good morning, Bill. Rabbi, Reverend Barry.
Good morning,
Rabbi, we were talking last week, and that Reverend Bob had thrown out the question, the source of forgiveness, and I had been thinking about that. And then I was wondering about substitutional atonement as being the only model or basis for mm-hmm. forgiveness or repentance or anything. Right. And there's something about that strikes me as atavistic in a way. And
Mike, can you explain for the less bright people, especially me, what does atavistic mean? What does atavistic mean?
That means referring to a more primitive, earlier view or...
Like gods need to eat.
Well, that, I don't know.
No, I'm just giving you an example.
Anyway, just I always thought of or have thought of repentance in terms of contrition and repentance and not doing it anymore and stuff like that, more of a mm-hmm. psychological model. And then I was asking people's views on if that was a necessary component of forgiveness or atonement, you know, the what I consider the atavistic thing about like animal sacrifice and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I was talking to Rabbi about it, and he said he mentioned something that he mentions from time to time, magical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think he was, and I'm saying he, I'm, Rabbi, I'm talking to you, I think you were explaining some kind of nuance between about the efficacy of ritual.
Yeah.
And somehow your answers are pretty deep sometimes, kind of Talmudic, you know, and sometimes after my 3 minutes are up, I'm sitting there wondering what that was. And I was just What is your
adult radio
magical thinking versus an efficacious ritual?
Say that again, Mike.
Give me an example of the difference between magical thinking in this area.
Sure, of course. Magical thinking is the notion that if I do a particular rite, ceremony, with the correct formula and the correct geometry or geography or whatever, that whatever I am wanting or needing or expecting will now be in order and will occur because I've done the right ritual. I've done the right ceremony. As opposed to that a ritual is a way of imagining what I need, want, hope, will, desire, which is to say, imagine making the image clear to me and perhaps even others of how I hope to engage. Now, ritual does have a magical quality to elevate and challenge if it's good ritual. But the notion that the ritual in and of itself does the thing, that's magic.
Okay, would this relate
to... let me give you a really hard example, especially because it's not my tradition, okay? The notion that baptism automatically does everything. It might do a whole bunch, but it doesn't do everything if it's entered into insincerely, without any honest conviction that this is something I really want or need, or even better, confession. You know, I'm assuming, Bill, that one has to have real intentionality, not just going through the motions for confession to be meaningfully reconciling one with the Holy One. Is that a fair description?
There has to be sincere contrition for the sacrament of confession to be efficacious. Baptism, on the other hand, does not necessarily require. Now, God's not going to baptize you against your will. I mean, if someone was baptized against their will, but baptism would be one of the sacraments where it's efficacious if the form is followed. It is efficacious. I don't know if we'd call that magical thinking, but
it's an initiation ceremony for sure.
One of the strongest minority opinions in Christianity is the requirement of an immersion baptism. It's not a majority opinion, but it's very strongly held and very prominent. Of course, the question then becomes, how long do you have to hold them under for it to work? You know? But that's atavistic.
My only point is that the sacrificial cult, which is often viewed as somehow a great lack in Judaism's efficacy for its followers because we no longer have a sacrificial cult, was never, I shouldn't say never, people always embrace magical thinking. Yeah. God, if you let me get me out of this one, I'll go to services 400 times a year, you know?
Well, one of our rituals is we have to take a break and we're running a little bit. So thanks for calling, Mike. And if you're
good
on the line,
Mike.
Hold on. We've got Keith who wants to talk about J.C. Nichols. So we'll be right back. You've got Religion on the Line, and time is short, so we're going to get to this real quick. I'm Bill Scholl with the Office for Social Justice with the Archdiocese of Kansas City, Kansas, along with...
Pastor Barry Fries, retired United Methodist pastor, along with...
Rabbi Michael Zedek, Rabbi Emeritus Temple Ben Yehuda.
All right, and early in the show, Rabbi brought up the fact that there are people who want to compel, I don't know, is it the city or the plaza, to rename the J.C. Nichols Fountain, and we've got... because of his association with redlining, and we've got Keith, who wants to say something about that. Hey, Keith, you're on Religion on the Line.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just think that I'm not real familiar with J.C. Nichols and all the things he did, but the point that kind of came to me when Rabbi was talking about it is that you cannot take historical people, and try to give them the same standards that we have today. And too often that happens. They talk about all the time about taking down the Confederate soldiers' monuments and all of that. And I would even argue that Confederate soldiers are just as much patriots as the Union soldiers were, everybody fighting for what they thought their cause should be. Maybe J.C. Nichols being a racist wasn't so much a personal decision as it was like a historical position, if you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was part of the times.
Part of the times. So I don't know why these days we would penalize somebody for living in a time where things were normal.
I don't know.
As opposed to today where those normal things are no longer normal.
I don't know if that you're penalizing J.C. Nichols. I mean, he's gone to his reward, whatever that is, for him. But the question is, how do you hold together the current attitudes, the current understandings, with these older habits, peculiar institutions, and such? And that's the rub, I think.
Well, and Keith, what do you want to say?
Well, I'm just saying, while it may be true, it's still not fair to anybody in history to judge them on a standard that they were not familiar with at the time.
Yeah, but I guess then, well, I don't think anyone can disagree with that comment. I do think a question, I want everybody, I don't know whether it should be renamed or not, but I do know that what we're talking about is honoring, not living by certain standards. And he was, and I suspect that the Nichols Fountain is a city monument, even if it's maintained by the plaza, which used to be owned by the J.C. Nichols Company, has long since gone through other ownership. So I think the question is, how does this reflect on who and what we are, not who and what J.C. Nichols was?
I fully disagree with you.
Okay.
And the reason I fully disagree with you is because
you totally disagree. I haven't said that I want to change the name. I'm just saying that I think the question
is, look at history. Can you imagine if Jesus turned the water into wine? How would CNA call that today? They would be very upset because there may have been alcoholics in the crowd. And look what he did to those people.
That's as we call a red herring. I think the serious question is the tension between where a person was in their own time and what anything are said about our time. For example, the University of Mississippi decided that this particular segregationist person after whom a building was named, two disgraceful comments to keep that alive. Some of their other markers will have building names, which, clearly in those times, some of those people were slaveholders. And their notion is to put explanatory plaques at the University of Mississippi to further elucidate the nature of the person after whom the building is named.
Look,
seems to be an interesting approach.
Keith, thanks for calling. That is an interesting
job,
approach.
Keith.
We have to take a break. We'll be
God
right
bless.
Back. God bless.
All right, guys. Have a good day.